Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Monday, as we discussed Jim Crowism, was in the past, and it was dealing with how Jim Crowism had its bout with the North. Today, we're going to be listening and talking to what is happening in our society as a whole today, politically, that is speaking. And we have some great people who will be introduced telling you about what we should do and what we should expect. Let's begin.
Joining me now in the State of the Union is former Secretary of State and former Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Colin Powell. General, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Let's start right now with the extraordinary comments this week from several top former military officials, including former Secretary and General Jim Mattis, condemning President Trump's actions against protesters, his desire to have 10,000 active U.S. military in the streets of this nation. The President's former Chief of Staff, General Kelly, said he agreed with Mattis. Retired General John Allen says the President's threat to deploy U.S. military against American citizens, quote, may well signal the beginning of the end of the American experiment. Take a listen to what Allen told me Thursday.
I never believed that the Constitution was under threat until recently, and I have concerns about that. We should all be attentive right now to how the rule of law is being administered in this country.
What's your response to what's been going on the last week, General?
Well, first, thanks very much, Jake. I'm very happy with what General Allen said and all the other generals, admirals are saying, and diplomats are saying. We have a constitution, and we have to follow that constitution, and the president's drifted away from it. I'm so proud of what these generals and admirals have done and others have done. But, you know, I didn't write a letter because I made my point with respect to Trump's performance some 4 years ago when he was running for office. And when I heard some of the things he was saying, it made it clear that I could not possibly vote for this individual. The first thing that troubled me is the whole birthers movement. And birthers movement had it to do with the fact that the President of the United States, or President Obama, was a black man. That was part of it. And then I was deeply troubled by the way in which he was going around insulting everybody, insulting Gold Star mothers, insulting John McCain, insulting immigrants, and I'm the son of immigrants, insulting anybody who dared to speak against him. And that is dangerous for our democracy. It's dangerous for our country. And I think what we're seeing now, those massive protest movement I have ever seen in my life, I think this suggests that the country is getting rise to this and we're not going to put up with it anymore.
And former Defense Secretary General Mattis said, quote, Donald Trump is the first president in my lifetime who does not try to unite the American people, does not even pretend to try. Instead, he tries to divide us. It sounds like you agree with that.
You have to agree with it. I mean, look at what he has done to divide us. Forget immigrants, let's put up a fence in Mexico. Forget this, let's do this. He is insulting us throughout the world. He is being offensive to our allies. He is not taking into account what our foreign policy is and how it's being affected by his actions. So, yes, I agree with General Allen. I agree with all of my former colleagues. And remember, I've been out of the military now for 25 years. And so I'm watching them closely because they all were junior officers when I left. And I'm proud of what they're doing. I'm proud that they were willing to take the risk of speaking honesty and speaking truth to those who are not speaking truth.
We've seen tens of thousands of protesters taking to the streets this week in opposition to racial injustice and police brutality. What's been your personal reaction to this moment? Do you think that the country is in something of a turning point?
We are in turning points. I mean, the Republican Party, the president, thought they were sort of immune. They can go say anything they wanted. And even more troubling, the Congress would just sit there and not in any way resist what the president's doing. And the one word I have to use with respect to what he's been doing for the last several years is a word I would never have used before. I never would have used with any of the four presidents I've worked for. He lies. He lies about things. And he gets away with it because people will not hold him accountable. And so while we're watching him, we need to watch our Congress. I watched the senators heading into the chamber the other day after all this broke, with a reporter saying, what do you have to say? What do you have to say? They had nothing to say. They would not react. And so we're not a country of just a president. We have a Congress. We have a Supreme Court. But most of all, we have the people of the United States, the ones who vote, the ones who vote them in and the ones who vote them out. I couldn't vote for him in 96, and I certainly cannot in any way support President Trump this year.
So, yeah, I know you didn't vote for him in 2016. I assume, based on the fact that you approved Joe Biden when then-Senator Obama picked him to be his running mate in 2008, I assume you're going to be voting for Joe Biden?
I'm very close to Joe Biden on a social matter and on a political matter. I worked with him for 35, 40 years, and he is now the candidate, and I will be voting for him.
Let me ask you, during the Rodney King riots in 1992, you counseled then-President George H.W. Bush on a speech he was about to give. You wrote about this very movingly in your book. You wrote, quote, "I read it with dismay." This is the first copy of the speech. "I thought the tone was all wrong. Yes, the rioting was criminal and law and order had to be restored, but the violence had not incubated in isolation. It had deep social roots. The speech, as it stood, recognized only the former and ignored the latter. Do the law and order bit," you said, "but there's language here that's only going to fan the flames. Turn down the heat," I suggested. "Get some reconciliation into the president's message." And President George H.W. Bush did take your advice back in 1992. He talked about how he was disappointed that the cops who beat Rodney King had been acquitted, and on and on. President Trump has been emphasizing law and order. Do you think that he is talking enough about reconciliation and empathy and what the people in the streets are calling for in his message in any way?
No, he is not in any way that I recognize. He always is shooting toward his base. I remember the Bush conversation very, very vividly, because at the same time, we had to bring law and order back into the streets. And we worked with the state of California where it happened in Los Angeles, the riots. And the president called me and said, "We may have to do something." I said, "Mr. President, go to the governor. The governor has the National Guard. If the National Guard can't do it, then you come back to me with a decision, and we will send in federal troops." And we did. And we brought things under control rather quickly. But the president always followed the law, followed the Constitution, worked with the community, and we brought stability finally. It was a bad scene, but we got over it rather quickly.
Are you willing to campaign for Joe Biden for president?
Well, I haven't been asked, and I don't think I will be. Campaigning is not my strong suit, and I'll be speaking for him, but I don't plan to make campaign trips.
We should note that in addition to the role that you have assumed in American society, you also came in third in the Electoral College in 2016 because some rogue electors voted for you. So you're actually the third place finisher in 2016, even though you didn't even campaign in any way then.
It's true. I had to read it in a newspaper, and I called my wife. "Can this be so?" And with three electors in the state of Washington, and it was amusing, and I have clipped out the article, and I've clipped out the instructions that the House of Representatives put on there in their census, and it's now in my library at the National War College. So it was charming. The president kind of misrepresents what the final count was. I got three. I beat everybody else behind me, and it was amusing, but that's all there was to it. But three electors felt that they had the authority to change what they were planning to do. I think they've been fined for it, but it's a symbol of the kind of system we have, a democratic system that our fathers thought through rather, rather carefully and thoughtfully, and now we'll see how it works this year. I think this year is going to be a different kind of year. We have done things that have offended just about everybody in the world. Our friends are distraught with us. We are down on NATO. We are cutting more troops out of Germany. We've done away with our contribution to the World Health Organization. We're not that happy with the United Nations. And just about everywhere you go, you will find this kind of disdain for American foreign policy that is not in our interest. And we have to get on top of this. We have to start acting seriously. How can you say that we're going to take troops out of Germany, but we're also thinking of putting more in, and we're going to create a new headquarters in Germany that was a headquarters I commanded 25 years ago? We can make up our mind of what we're doing, but it seems to all come out of the White House without consultation with our Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is not the way the system is supposed to work. And until the president realizes that he needs to understand the Constitution, understand the restraints on him and his authority, and talk openly with his military authorities about what is the right thing to do, and not fire them when he doesn't get the answer he likes.
I want to ask you about foreign policy. As a former Secretary of State, the Chinese government is under a lot of scrutiny for how it handled the coronavirus pandemic early on, as well as its recent anti-democratic crackdown in Hong Kong. 2 years ago, you said we shouldn't create a Cold War situation with the Chinese. Are we in one, do you think?
We're in a bad situation right now because we're fighting over things that I don't think we need to fight over. The Chinese did not do well at the very beginning of this virus crisis. But at the same time, it was our intelligence community that was telling the administration, telling the president, beginning in December through January, February, and March, that we had this. And the president wouldn't respond to it. He kept trying to see if there's somebody else to blame. And so in order to get out of this, we're now blaming the Chinese for everything. Our relationship with the Chinese during my time as chairman or my time as Secretary of State was a healthy one. When they did things we didn't like, we told them about it. But more often, we were speaking to them as fellow individuals and a government that we could speak to. I did a lot with the Chinese, disagreed with them when they had to be disagreed with, but at the same time respected them and listened to what their point of view was right now, then. And right now, we ought to be listening carefully to what they're doing in Hong Kong, and we should not take action that just infuriates the situation and makes the situation worse.
Let's talk more, continue to talk more broadly about the role of the United States in the world. The editorial board of the Financial Times, a leading newspaper in the UK, wrote an editorial titled America's Battered Moral Standing, and they wrote in part, quote, Donald Trump is handing the world's autocrats a propaganda coup. Never before has a U.S. president demonized, in blanket terms, those protesting against injustice. If China were to send its tanks into Hong Kong, will the world listen to what the U.S. Senate thought? Do you agree that our moral standing as Americans is being battered because of the way the attitude President Trump has, not only to our allies, but to citizens protesting peacefully?
Our moral standing has been demonized by what not only the world is thinking, but they're just looking at us. They're looking at these demonstrations. They see that these are demonstrations that are justified and not to be criticized. They see that George, as the president called him, was murdered. And the president comes down and says, well, George is looking down from heaven and blessing what I'm doing. How can you expect anybody to believe things like that? That's the kind of language we see coming from overseas. And the overseas clients that we have, our friends and some of our adversaries, looking at how we are taking care of our people. Are we insulting everybody? Are we going after immigrants? They don't understand this. I'm the son of immigrants. I wouldn't be here if my parents couldn't come here in banana boats in the 1920s. This is America. This is who we are. And the world doesn't understand.
President Trump said this week that it's common sense for Russia to be allowed to rejoin the G7 after Russia was expelled after it annexed Crimea in 2014. What do you think of that? Should Russia be allowed to rejoin the G7?
Let me answer it this way. Why is he making this decision all by himself at the same time that Russia has been listed as one of our four enemies that we have to be dealing with? In reality, they are not. They're not one of our four enemies. As one Israeli prime minister said to me in a very simple way, Colin, we've lost our enemies. Now all we have are problems. We have problems. And so we have a situation where Pentagon has identified four enemies, China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Not one of them is about to attack us right now. We're sending huge sums. We need to get to those problems in Afghanistan, Somalia, elsewhere, and start to help solve those. And so the world is listening, and what are they hearing? They're hearing this, we don't like immigrants. We don't want them in. Let's kick them out. We're hearing that we don't like so many of our ethnic people, the ethnic slices that America represents. We don't like that, and they speak out against it. It's our strength. It's been our strength for 200 years. And we ought to stick up for our immigration policies. We ought to stick up for our minorities. We ought to put more money into lower income classes of Americans. We need to get our kids educated, white and black, all of them, get educated like I was educated in the public school system of New York. And I'm now in a graduate of a public college in New York, and have been rather successful with this public school education. That's the kind of education all of our young people should have, and it is a major priority in my lifetime and among my friends.
Last question for you, sir, and we really do appreciate your time today. There are a lot of independent voters out there, or moderates, Democrats and Republicans, who might be concerned that the Democratic Party is drifting too far to the left, and they hear your comments about President Trump. Why is it so important to you that President Trump not be reelected?
Because I think he has been not an effective president. He lies all the time. He began lying the day of the inauguration when we got into an argument about the size of the crowd that was there. People are writing books about his favorite thing of lying, and I don't think that's in our interest. I didn't vote for him in 2006. The situation for 2020 in my mind, in my life, has gotten worse. Every American citizen has to sit down, think it through, and make a decision on their own. Don't listen to everybody out there. Don't read every newspaper. Think it through. Use your common sense and say, is this good for my country, before you say this is good for me. We have a lot of people who are earning great wealth. And when I've talked to some of them, they said, well, gee, the economy's doing great. I'm doing great. The economy exists for all of the American people, not just you doing great or me doing better. So what we have to do now is reach out to the whole people. Watch these demonstrations. Watch these protests. And rather than curse them, embrace them to see what it is we have to do to get out of the situation that we find ourselves in now. We're America. We're Americans. We can do this. We have the ability to do it, and we ought to do it. Make America not just great, but strong, and great for all Americans, not just a couple.
Retired General Colin Powell, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, former Secretary of State, we're honored with your presence today. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Jake.
Joining me now in a State of the Union exclusive, former Secretary of State and former Joint Chiefs Chairman, General...
Well, I think you heard one of my favorites, Colin Powell, who always tells it like it is, always shoots straight from the hip. And what he says makes a lot of sense. It's not just words that you hear somebody saying in passing. We're going to stick with the military for a minute, and we're going to hear another general and see what that particular general has to say. And hopefully that'll come out.
Well, during... I have something to ask you. Will you add your name to join my campaign?
I've seen both of you in other appearances. I follow your Twitter feed very closely. I just want to hear what's on your mind, General McCaffrey.
Well, in 50 years of dealing with national security issues, I've never seen anything like this. I worked in both Democratic and Republican White Houses from the national security issues. Nicole, what is the chance, from your experience, that the intelligence agency will be reporting that the GRU is putting out a bounty on U.S. soldiers? It was widely disseminated. It was the subject of an NSC meeting of the policy group. And that the president made, as far as I can tell, 5 phone calls to Putin, and nobody came in and said, Mr. President, this guy's trying to murder your soldiers. Obviously, he knew about it. There's no question in my mind. And he was so keen on being subservient to Russian and Putin interests for whatever reason, trying to get them to join the G7, that he took no action. Normally, when our troops get threatened in a battle zone like Afghanistan, we tell the Intel guys to find those who are threatening us, and we go kill them. That should have been the first response, followed by a diplomatic approach to the Russians, telling them to knock it off. So I think, it's shocking.
General McCaffrey, I don't want to let that go. I don't want to keep going. I mean, what are the chances? The chances are zero. And I worked for a president who advocated policies that were plenty controversial, and he will live with that legacy till the end of time. But any threat to American soldiers anywhere, any threat to Americans anywhere was brought to him at any point, whether it was a tip, whether it was corroborated, whether it was about to be realized. What is the dysfunction if they have to share? I mean, here's the problem with the White House response. Either they shield him from any credible leads, and as you said, this was credible enough that we alerted the British. They convened the deputies, and it sounds like a principal's meeting, in the West Wing of the White House, and the New York Times is reporting they ran the fight, they ran the money down. They already found the money. That's usually the end of the investigation. So it would suggest that the CIA, the Pentagon, the State Department, if the British have been alerted, and maybe even the FBI, Adam Goldman just said they're investigating it like a crime. They all know, and either the president can't handle the truth, or he knew and was still courting Vladimir Putin. What does that say about Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin?
It's actually inexplicable. I don't think the Russians can believe their eyes and ears that they've got somebody acting to further their interests, embracing them in public, attacking their European Union, NATO adversaries for them. It's simply astonishing. It's not to be understood. For 20 years from now, the Russians, by the way, when he's out of office, the Russians will out him, and they'll say, here's how we were able to influence Trump. But for now, what we've got on the face of it is someone who refuses to confront Russian adversarial efforts, which include killing our troops. So we got a problem. Congress's oversight function, where were they? What did Secretary Esper tell the CENTCOM commander? Why didn't the CIA run their own covert operation to bag some of these Russians in Afghanistan? Why didn't we jam the bank accounts? These people bear a heavy responsibility. Our national security process is broken.
Governor Burke, you were part of that national security process. I imagine it pains you to hear that. Would you agree?
I couldn't agree more. Look, this story is just sickening on so many levels. Think about it from the vantage point of our men and women over there in Afghanistan. I've spent 50 of my professional career in war zones with these men and women. And there's an assumption that the commander in chief, they're under his command, and they're all under his care. And something from the president of the LNP, that means it was a significant report to be before the president. He's been briefed on it. He knows about it. And you just presume that he will take action. And here, it's not just the president, maybe he didn't know, he didn't do anything. He spoke with Putin, something McCaffrey just said, five or six times. After he was not only did he speak with him, he invited him back into the G7. So this is totally inexplicable, but there's a larger point. And I guess to the PDB. The PDB is the most, one of the most important documents in the world, one of the most rigorously constructed documents in the world. The president not only was getting this information earlier this year, but in January and February, according to the Washington Post, it doesn't read about the pandemic coming out of China.
Right.
And the president at that time was talking to Xi Jinping, saying everything's fine. This is a president that is a voracious consumer of boxing friends in the morning, but is not a voracious consumer of intelligence that is being presented to him to keep our country and the personal safe. One deep trouble here, and this is just another dot in the mosaic. This, you know, say it can't get worse. This story is unbelievable. Just final point, you can hear, I was at an NCC meeting. It's my job to consume intelligence. I spent an hour every morning doing that. And you ask yourself, in that position, what do I know after reading this? Who needs to know? And did I tell them? And if this is in the book, Russia has a change of policy to target our troops and put bounties on our troops. The president needs to know. Everybody, General McCaffrey did not even know, right? The Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Chief of Staff. Everybody reading that intelligence needs to be adding that more, but the Oval to say, Mr. President, you have a problem. And the next time you speak with Vladimir Putin, you need to say something about it.
Well, which part of this endangers U.S. troops more? The fact that this is where that the Russians are so brazen that they're, you know, one, transferring money from GRU-linked accounts to the Taliban, not taking more care to hide the money. They certainly must know we'd go looking for it. Or that the Russians now know that Trump, when it is known, when it is revealed, that Russians paid the Taliban to slaughter U.S. soldiers did nothing.
Well, it's both. And even the fact that not the House, the President still has not, it's been unbelievable. The President has not once said, I'm going to get to the bottom of this, I'm going to make sure that my people are protected, and I'm going to take action to protect my people. He acts like this is all about him. It's not all about him. It's about our men and women who are overseas. It's about the protection of our country. So I agree with General McCaffrey. I have negotiated with the Washington State Department on a very difficult issue such as Syria, where you literally say, if you cross this line, we will kill you. Okay, that's kind of the conversation. But the Russians know, any diplomat who is facing off against the Russians, they know, on the other side of the table, that the President does not have the back of a diplomat. He does not have the back of our soldiers. Because Putin can get on the phone and Trump will change his mind in a moment. Every world leader knows this. Erdogan, Xi Jinping. It has put our country at risk. And, you know, there's under something days in the election. There's only 7 months until we may have a new president. A lot can happen in the next 7 months.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the middle of a public health crisis, an economic crisis, a racial justice crisis. The one thing we don't have is an international security crisis. But I would anticipate one is coming. And this White House and this president is so dysfunctional that you're not ready to handle it. It's a just incredibly serious moment in our country. And this is just one dot in the mosaic of everything we've been talking about it for a couple of years since I came out of the Trump administration.
Yeah.
It's just one more piece of the puzzle.
You know, I want to get both of you on one more question. You know, Donald Trump likened the intelligence community to Nazis after he was elected, before he was inaugurated. Then he went after Jim Comey because he refused to drop the Flynn investigation. Then he smeared Andy McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, I guess because his wife had the audacity to run for office. Then he went after the 17 State Department and career diplomats who testified in the impeachment trial. He extorted a foreign leader. None of this elicited a peep. Nothing from any Republican other than Mitt Romney. And now we've got, according to the New York Times, three American soldiers who lost their lives because Russians paid bounties to Taliban militants. Trump was briefed on it and did nothing. Was the Republican Party still a party, General McCaffrey?
Well, no, I kind of evade, you know, strictly partisan issues. I know a lot of these senators in particular who are Republicans and admire them. They're just good people. Rob Portman, certainly an example, and others. And it absolutely is mystifying to me that they're remaining silent in the face of not just Mr. Trump's absolute lack of character, but also actions that he's taking that endanger the United States. I mean, the whole notion of yanking a third of our troops out of Germany in an obvious tiff over Angela Merkel refusing to come to the G7 meeting because the Russians will be there. It's just amazing. He takes actions in public that are favorable to our adversaries. He's an impulsive, crude, ignorant man when it comes to these national security issues. And by the way, that's not really a new finding. Helsinki, to me, was a turning point. I've worked with the CIA for 30 years. These are some of the smartest people in our government. They're dedicated. They're brave. They get killed overseas all the time, to include in Afghanistan. And for him to publicly disown his own loyal, talented public servants is astonishing. We are in trouble.
I'll give you the last word. I mean, you quit over something that the Republicans really were pretty quiet about. It was Donald Trump's actions in Syria. I think Secretary Mattis also walked away over a policy disagreement that resulted in grave danger and the death of our allies, the Kurds. I mean, are you surprised that there isn't a political party on the right that stands for the men and women of the national security agencies, like the military, like the CIA, who can't speak out for themselves?
Well, I served in the Bush White House for 4 years, and I know President Bush at one point was down at 28% approval.
I remember.
There's a lot of partisanship. We never had serious briefings about intelligence at one political party. So, you know, maybe it was a different time. I want to be optimistic and say it's not the same thing to come out with a very strong statement. Like any American leader should say, we're going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to protect our people. If this is true, there will be consequences. That should not be hard to say. So I certainly hope that Republican members say that. I hope the president says it. But I just agree with John McCaffrey. We're in trouble. It's not just this story. It's the fact that this president is not doing his job, the first job of the president, to keep our country and our people safe.
There you had it. You've heard information concerning the security of the whole United States. You heard the politics in terms of what might be out there for the up-and-coming election in November. We heard from two outstanding generals who actually gave a pretty good understanding, a pretty good presentation. So it'll be very easy for you and I to understand what a major problem we have in the White House. And then you heard about race. We're going to go on and hear some more about the racial issue. But this time we're going to go back in history and listen to what happened in 1946. See, most people believe that things concerning race have only happened every now and then. But this thing has been going on even before I was a child, before my parents were children, and even before my grandfather was a child. So, and he was born in 1778. So that should give you a pretty good idea of what we're talking about. Let's listen to something that it was called the Columbia Race Riot.
This program is brought to you by Emory University.
In 1946, the race riot in Columbia, Tennessee, was a phenomenon that begins to speak to the militancy of black veterans and the black community coming out of that Second World War. What happened is, you know, many of these things start off with something really simple. What happened was a woman named Gladys Stevenson, a black woman, wanted to get her radio repaired. She took it to a shop. The guy told her it was going to cost so much to get it fixed, and it would be done by such and such a date. She goes back to pick it up. He tells her it's going to cost more. She's like, I don't have that kind of money. It's like, yeah, things are there sometimes. And so they go back and forth, back and forth. Then he sells her radio, and then he tells her it's going to cost more for her to get it back from the guy that he just sold it to. Next time she comes in with her son, who's a Navy veteran. Because when she gets the radio, it doesn't work. He's cut off the electric cord and the batteries don't work. And he's charged her double the price that he originally said it was going to cost. They get into a heated argument. In this heated argument, it looks like somebody, one of the assistants, is getting ready to smack the woman. And this veteran, let me be real clear, this veteran used to box. This veteran was not going to let somebody smack his mother, and he steps in between. And the fact that you have a black man in Tennessee in 1946 basically stepping up saying, oh, no, you are not going to lay your hands on my mother. Come on, Mom, let's go. And so she's walking out. The son is walking out. The man is so angry, he bam! And he hits the veteran in the back of the head. Now, veteran doesn't go down. Veteran turns around and it's like, oh, snap! Bam! And the battle is on. He's pounding him, pounding him, pounding him. They go through a glass window. This is 1946. You get a black man hitting a white man, going through a glass window. As they go through the glass window of the radio shop, whites are around looking, going, what is this? What is this? And so a few more whites go in there to try to beat on the veteran because I'm like, my God, you've got a black man hitting a white man. This is absolutely criminal. Well, when the mother sees folks attacking her son, she's like, oh, that's my baby boy. That's my baby boy. She comes after she picks up one of the shards of glass and she starts slashing. They both get pounded. They both get arrested. And the lynch mob is like, oh, we're going to have to do something here. You know, these folks have gotten a little too uppity. Who do they think they are? talking back and hit. Did you see what they did? They pulled the ball over there. Oh, that's unacceptable. Unacceptable. And you start getting this reeling around of the crowd around the jail. Well, the black community hears about, sees the milling around, starts hearing the word, we're going to get a rope, we're going to get a rope, we're going to get a rope. And they start moving. They work to get the son and the mother out of Columbia, Tennessee. The lynch mob is coming. Black folks start organizing. And it is one of the things, I mean, we think of like Martin Luther King and nonviolence. But one of the things is that there has been a tradition in the black community of self-defense. And so what they do is they get their shotguns, because remember, everybody's got a gun. They get their shotguns, they get their rifles, they get their pistols, and they start taking up purchase on top of the buildings in the black community, the area known as the Bottoms of Meek Slide. And so as whites start pouring in, and there was one guy who had he was going to burn down the black businesses. So he's going to run to Tulsa, going to burn down the black businesses. And he comes in there with his buddies and a can of gasoline, and he starts trying to zigzag and pour the gasoline, and all of a sudden the black guys on top of the roof start shooting. Bam! Bam! It's like, did black folks just shoot at white folks? Did we just get shot? Wait a minute. What? So the weed and lights get pulled out, and it's like, oh my God, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And the crowd is coming. The crowd is coming. Now the sheriff is first in there going, okay, boys, now you just need to settle down. We'll handle this. And the crowd is like, no, no, no. Call in the Tennessee National Guard, the Tennessee State Guard. As they're coming in, as more whites of the mob are coming in, black folks are defending their property because there had been lynchings in that county before. They knew what this looked like. And this is 1946. You had veterans up on those roofs. They had taken down the Nazis. They weren't having it. For them, this was a new day. And even though they had been systematically cut out of the GI Bill, and part of that, let me describe that piece, being cut out of the GI Bill. It was passed in 1944, and it opened up a range of opportunities to veterans. It opened up housing opportunities, so through the VA loans. It opened up education, so it a full ride through college for veterans. But the way that the law was written was that although it's a federal law and it's written race neutral, in the language it said that it will be administered by the states. And so when you're looking at these Jim Crow states that cannot fathom that a black man should have access to education, what you're getting are these veterans who are watching these opportunities pass them by. And the thing that they're going to do at the bare minimum is to protect their homestead, to protect their community, and to protect one of theirs. And so as whites are coming in, these veterans are shooting back. So when the sun comes up, the state troopers move in. And I mean they moved in with machine guns. Moved in and started rounding up. You were brave last night. Are you brave this morning? Because we're getting ready to take you down. At the very end, you get beatings, shootings. About 25 African Americans are arrested for attempted murder. Now, I see self-defense. What Tennessee saw was attempted murder for shooting at the guys who are trying to burn down the black neighborhood, for shooting at the mob that is trying to go in and destroy the black neighborhood. Well, the Tennessee stormtroopers basically did that as they went rummaging through the black business section, looking for the guns, looking for the rifles. Well, they weren't finding too much. And none of the ballistics were matching up. But in the trial that happened, the trial itself becomes fascinating because as the lynch mob is forming and as it's very clear that the bullets are flying, somebody calls in to Nashville and says, alert the NAACP, we're in trouble down here. The NAACP then sends its attorneys to help these 25 black men who have now been arrested for attempted murder, charged, indicted for attempted murder. the defense was absolutely brilliant. I mean, brilliant. Z. Alexander Luby, who was the black attorney out of Nashville, one of the first things he did was to begin to challenge the jury, you know, what they call that voir dire process, where it's like, do you have any biases against black folks? Do you really think that you can be fair and impartial? No. Next. Do you remember the Klan? Well, yeah. Next. And so to find them, you can't make this stuff up. So by the time they were able to get 12 jurors who couldn't be impartial, and then because the state's case was so weak, they didn't have the evidence, and V. Alexander Luby is arguing, this is self-defense. This is one of the basic rights that we know of as Americans. We honor this. We cherish this. In the first round, 23 of the 25 men were found not guilty. Yeah. Now we have the other two. Thurgood Marshall, from the head office of the NAACP, comes down to take part in this case for the final two. They, again, laid out a brilliant, beautiful strategy. It so infuriated the law enforcement folks in Columbia, Tennessee, that what they did was, after the end of the trial, Z. Alexander Luby, Thurgood Marshall, who had become the first black Supreme Court justice of the United States, and two other men are in a car, and they're leaving Columbia. And they're like, whew, man, that was, you know, that was bad, yeah, okay, this is good. Cops pull them over. They didn't think it was the cops because they were in plain clothes, and the cars were unmarked. But when you get that kind of close behind, so they pulled over. First thing they did was they're looking in the car for open containers, convinced that somebody's been drinking. They went and bought some Coca-Cola at the local store, but they weren't drinking hard liquor. There was no booze in the car. So cops were like, get in the car. Oh, man, didn't find any moonshine, didn't find any wine, didn't find any whiskey. They drive a little bit further. Cops pull them over again. Let's see their license. They ask Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall hands over his license. Man, it's not expired. There's nothing wrong with this license. There's nothing we can do anymore. He gets his license back, drives a little bit further. Then cops pull him over a third time. In this third time, they're like, you're driving drunk. He's like, I've had some water and I've had some Coca-Cola. Yeah, you look drunk to me. Get out of the car. They pull Thurgood Marshall out of the car, throw him into their car. Now, there's a white guy in the car named Harry Wayman. And he looks up and he's like, wait a minute. They're not going back to the city to arraign him or to arrest him or anything like that. They're driving off into the woods. So he hops over and he starts following the cars that have Thurgood Marshall in them. They look up. They turn right, he turns right. They turn left, he turns left. They slow down, he slows down. They speed up, he speeds up. And he's thinking, they're going to lynch him. They're taking him off into the woods to lynch him. They're going to lynch Thurgood Marshall. My God, they're going to lynch Thurgood Marshall. Finally, they turn this way, he turns this way. They stop the car. He stops the car. He gets up. They're like, what are you doing? Cops, what are you doing? And he's like, I know what you're planning, and I'm not going to let you do it. They said, what? He said, I know what you're planning. And you're going to think about this. He really had no backup. I mean, you are out here in the woods in Tennessee. You are dealing with men who are strapped. They have guns. You don't. This is nothing but the sheer raw courage of principle and doing what I'm not going to let you do it. I'm like, fine. they try to then get Thurgood arranged for, so they won't actually turn him over, they turn back around and go to the city. And then they try to arrest him for drunk driving. Joseph Simpson says, this man's about to, come on, y'all. Dismiss, let him go. But in that one moment, you in fact see so much about the role of law enforcement in the South that doesn't enforce the law. Another strain of law enforcement that, come on, y'all. There's some element of the Constitution we have to uphold. So you're looking at this really contested terrain, and in the middle of this contested terrain, you have African Americans who refuse to go into their place, who refuse to just stand there and take it, and who refuse to just abide by the old ways because they're like, no, this is a new day. And it's that new day that I think really is emblematic of the race riot in Columbia, Tennessee.
The preceding program is copyrighted by Emory University.
You got a chance to get an opportunity to see all the different kinds of things, or at least hear about another situation going back as far as a person who later on became a Supreme Court justice who was a member of the NAACP, where these policemen were getting ready to lynch that man who later on became a Supreme Court justice. And just think, if they did what they wanted to do, that face basically means we would not have had a Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court. Let's even look at another. This one's called the Elaine Massacre, the bloodiest racial conflict in U.S. history.
I don't. That's how we create an ad remover. It's a product that makes it so you never have to see another ad on any website ever again. Now, if that doesn't interest you, go ahead and click the skip button.
It was called the Red Summer of 1919, named for the blood that ran through America's cities during months of racial unrest. African-American soldiers had returned home from the Great War to a country still teeming with discrimination. And in their quest for civil rights, tensions between blacks and whites reached a tipping point. Deadly race riots broke out in over 24 cities, but one rural town, Elaine, Arkansas, would become the epicenter for the bloodshed. The violence there, lynch mobs, torture, indiscriminate murder, was so horrific it would go down in history not as a race riot, but as the Elaine Massacre. This is history. Dark history. During World War I, more than 350,000 African-American soldiers enlisted to serve. But while they fought for democracy abroad, their own country, America, was still not willing to see them as equal.
White supremacy was very mainstream at this time in the United States. Basically, a lot of African-Americans were seeking to obtain their full rights and equality in the United States. And violence was often used by mobs of whites.
Tensions reached a boiling point in the summer of 1919. Race riots broke out in dozens of cities across the country. But in the rural South, something even more menacing was taking form. There, slavery existed in all but name. In a system called sharecropping, farmers provided landowners with labor for a share of crops produced. But the system was rigged. Sharecroppers were often kept in perpetual debt.
One black sharecropper raised $500 worth of cotton, and his landlord told him, yeah, but you used $697 worth of supplies, so you owe me money. Everyone who has any power at this point is working to make sure they keep African-American laborers tied to the land.
For roughly 50 years, the system went unchecked. In the fall of 1918, a black man from Arkansas had had enough. Roger Hill had decided to form a union to represent sharecroppers. It was a dangerous decision, and one that would set off a chain of events involving mass murder, torture, and a landmark Supreme Court ruling. But first, he would need to organize.
In his message, Hill was pretty simple and direct. Why is it that we cannot have fair payment for the honest and hard work we do?
Despite the inherent risk involved with challenging whites, World War I veterans and other black sharecroppers became card-carrying members of the Progressive Farmers and Household Union of America.
We believe that by paying dues, these members could have the services of lawyers and sue plantation owners for cotton that had been stolen from them and false numbers that have been placed in the plantation stores' books.
On the night of September 30th, 1919, Union members gathered in Elaine to discuss their legal plan.
This is in Phillips County. It's basically just a crossroads at this time, a road, a few houses, a railroad siding, no streetlights. There's also one room wooden church, and that's where the Union met. Expecting that they might have trouble, the Union posted a guard of about six men. They had shotguns and rifles. The meeting's taking place. While they're having this discussion, a car rolls up the road.
Two white men were in the car.
By one account, one of the white men in the car said, "You all get away from there." And shortly thereafter, a shot was fired.
Though it remains unclear who fired first, a barrage of gunfire broke out. One of the white men was killed almost instantly. The rumor of a black uprising spread in a matter of hours. The idea of a sharecropper rebellion conveniently played into the hands of landowners who did not want their sharecropping practices scrutinized. They did all they could, as quickly as they could, to sound alarms that black farmers were out for white blood.
The story gets magnified that the town is under attack, that blacks are killing people in the streets, that there is a revolution afoot.
The sharecroppers quickly formed self-defense groups, expecting repercussions over the death of a white man. But they could not have predicted just how severe the response would be. The following morning, under the watchful eye of Sheriff Frank Kitchens and his deputies, posses of white men were sent to find, detain, and kill the offenders.
When you have an out-of-control mob just being told that there's a Negro insurrection going on, that mob is being very indiscriminate and violent. You see houses being packed, black-owned homes being ransacked.
The black school was burnt. Notable families were killed.
Black women and children have to go literally hide out in the woods because many of these people are indiscriminately shooting at African-American women and their children.
Black veterans and other African-Americans took up arms in self-defense.
This no doubt just feeds into the mob fervor. The fact that, oh, they're daring to shoot back at us. This must really be an insurrection.
One historian has identified more than 20 different killing sites where African Americans were being killed.
There are stories that mob members were taking souvenirs, such as ears or fingers from the bodies of fallen African Americans.
One of the leading black families of the county, they weren't even in the town. They had just received a brother back from the French front. They are pulled from a train, put in the back of a car, and they are stabbed, shot, and their mutilated bodies are left on the side of the road.
Within 2 days, 500 U.S. troops were sent to quell the supposed black uprising.
They don't find any blacks killing or shooting down the street. In fact, Colonel Jinks reports that the city is filled with hundreds and hundreds of white men with guns. Many of the individuals who were hiding in the thickets were former soldiers who had just gotten back from the war. And when they see the army troops come, they rush out, believing that the army troops are there to assist. The army believes that these people are rushing toward them to attack, and they're cut down by machine gun fire.
Although the exact number will never be known, a recent estimate suggests 237 black men, women, and children were killed. There was an immediate demand for justice, but not for the black lives lost. Five white men were also killed in the fighting. Hundreds of African Americans were rounded up and put in jail, and when the jail was full, they detained the rest in a schoolhouse.
While they are detained, there is torture going on.
The goal? To elicit false confessions of a black uprising.
They ripped the neck, ripped them for long periods of time. They stuck formaldehyde up their noses, and they stripped them naked and shot them with electrical charges. They did this until they confessed to the conspiracy.
Robert Hill escaped to Kansas, but his peers back in Arkansas were not as lucky. 122 indictments were issued, and trials quickly started.
The men were brought into the court in chains. They weren't allowed to consult with their defense attorney. The defense attorney rarely interjected. And then the all-white jury started delivering
guilty verdicts. In one case, the guilty verdicts came back in 2 minutes.
It's also important to point out that there were mobs of people outside who were demanding black blood. Governor Brush maintained that at some point these people would be killed, but they would have to have been killed just.
The governor lived up to his word. Among the 87 black citizens charged with crimes, 12 were sentenced to death by electric chair. Despite the system being blatantly rigged against them, the convicted men had one unlikely beacon of hope. The American justice system. The trials of the Elaine 12 had been highly publicized. The NAACP took notice and stepped in with legal help for the 12. For 4 years, the team faced a series of legal setbacks and advances, until in 1923, the case made its way to the Supreme Court in what is now known as Moore versus Dempsey. There, the defense argued that the original trials had been mob-dominated, and the black prisoners had been denied their constitutional rights. In a landmark decision, the court agreed.
The good that comes out of this is that the NAACP sees for the first time that it can win in the Supreme Court, that things don't always fall along the color lines.
The 12, subjected to torture, injustice, and litigation travesty, were at long last exonerated and released in January 1925. They might have escaped with their lives, but there was nothing that could reverse the pain and devastation felt by the black community in Phillips County, and no way to unsee the ungodly truth that American men, alongside the American government, were complicit in a massacre of American citizens on American soil.
We as a nation have grown and we continue to grow. We don't need to pretend as if we've always had everything figured out. But if we are to do justice to who we are as Americans, we've got to own all of it.
So we always hear about slavery. We've now been hearing about Jim Crowism. And to go one step further, we are hearing a lot about and seeing some of the same kinds of things that happened in the 60s, with the riots in the late 60s. We're seeing some of the same kinds of things occurring right now. Now, I'm telling you about various periods of big things, however, this kind of situation goes on every day of the week. And this is something that constantly happens over and over and over. Now I'm going to take you to another race massacre. Let's listen to this.
It was a horrific time for our nation.
It's American history, it's Oklahoma history, it's the history of the city.
An event so terrible, many history books have shamefully left it out.
I was surprised to learn how much my kids did not know.
They're talking about the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot, or as many know it, the Tulsa Race Massacre.
This was our nation's worst race riot.
Michelle Brown is with the Greenwood Cultural Center. Her office sits on the very spot where nearly 40 acres of vibrant, prosperous property was destroyed, and at least 300 innocent African Americans were senselessly killed. It's a repulsive, violent act that is still affecting lives today.
Having not received any type of reparations, just now being at a point where we are truly acknowledging this history, there's a lot of historical trauma that they are experiencing.
Dr. Carlos Hill teaches African and African-American studies at the University of Oklahoma.
What had been one of the wealthiest communities, most educated communities, most peaceful communities in the country was destroyed in less than 18 hours.
The hatred overflowed on May 31st, 1921, after a young black man named Dick Rowland entered the Drexel Building in downtown Tulsa and stepped aboard an elevator being operated by a white woman named Sarah Page.
Dick Rowland walks into the elevator, Sarah Page is there. The elevator door closes, there's a screen, the door opens again. And she runs out.
Within hours, Rowland had been accused of assault, even rape. He's arrested and placed in the city's jail. Newspapers in town begin to run their version of the story.
Newspapers in Tulsa begin to report an assault
and even a rape.
As the story spread through the white neighborhoods, so did the anger.
And there's talk of a lynching, that Derrick Rowland's going to be taken from the jail and lynched that night.
A small group of armed African-American men go twice to speak with the sheriff, offering their support to help guard the city jail from the angry massing mob. The sheriff declines both times, but as the men are meeting the second time, a white person confronts the group.
And he tries to take away a gun from one of the men.
The African-American men stand their ground.
And a melee ensues. The gun is fired. A white person is shot. And from that point, as we would say, all hell breaks loose.
The African-American men retreat down the road to the Greenwood District.
And they are followed very closely by other white men.
Gunfire continues to be exchanged between the groups.
When daybreak came, there's an even larger group of whites that have sort of mobilized. And at daybreak, they enter into the Greenwood District.
What was a neighborhood of intellect, family values, some of the most successful African-Americans in the country became a war zone.
Began to burn, loot, should kill innocent people, bystanders.
African Americans caught in the violent racist attack were killed, their livelihoods wiped from the map.
Their community was destroyed, their homes were destroyed, their businesses were destroyed, their churches were destroyed, their schools were destroyed.
Since then, Tulsa has been left with a scar that is yet to heal, rulings that have caused distrust of city leaders and allowed for systemic racist policies to dictate the lives of African Americans in Tulsa.
So the way that they feel about the police, the way they feel about city officials, the way they feel about being citizens of Tulsa.
Michelle Brown says only in learning the full history of the Tulsa race massacre can one begin to see the pain it has caused Tulsans for a century.
When we realize and acknowledge the history, we understand some of what they are experiencing emotionally and mentally and even spiritually.
That's why having the knowledge and courage to educate Tulsa's youth about our history is critical.
For a lot of kids, when they think of topics like segregation, they think of the deep South, and they don't really connect it to Oklahoma and Tulsa.
Sherita Ashley teaches history at Edison Preparatory School. She says educating students about the race massacre helps them self-reflect and grow as young adults.
It made more real for them because they could connect to places they knew in town, parts of town that they had lived in the past or live in currently, and understand why there's so much difference between different segments of Tulsa.
But having these conversations has proved difficult for many adults, even teachers.
They did not feel comfortable talking about this part of history in their classrooms. They didn't know how to discuss it and address it.
Brown, saying many educators she's mentored lacked enough knowledge to facilitate meaningful conversations.
They did not know enough about it to be able to educate their students about it.
For Sherita Ashley, the educational process for teachers begins with self-awareness.
And be okay with accepting that you've done things wrong, and it's okay. You know, you're a person, you're a human, and you realize this hasn't been working, and it's okay to change that.
Saying it's important to be okay with being uncomfortable, knowing students have a safe place to learn, discuss, and express themselves about the terrible events during the Tulsa race massacre.
So I think by having kids exposed to teachers who can guide them and facilitate those types of discussions, helps the kids see how to facilitate those discussions.
They need to be aware of and be able to understand sort of how this issue still impacts them, how it still impacts their community.
That they give students the freedom to respond as openly and honestly as they would like, giving the opportunity to express themselves.
The hope is that by educating students about the Tulsa race massacre and the lasting effects still resonating in Tulsa today,
the biggest strides and the biggest changes are definitely going to come in having kids grow up and take in those positions of power. They become the teachers, they become the leaders.
That they can grow into more well-informed adults that can create positive, lasting change in Tulsa.
Most of these students, as history has shown us, will be here. They'll be leaders in our city, and they can see where these problems started,
and they can figure out where to go from here.
Hoping one day the deadly racist attack will serve as a reminder of our evil past, but also highlight the qualities of African Americans who endured such terrible acts of violence and oppression.
It was an attempted expulsion that was unsuccessful, and I think probably the thing that Black people are most proud about in relationship to the Tulsa Race Riot or the massacre is the fact that the community was rebuilt.
That African Americans in Tulsa would not break to the pressure of racism and injustice.
It's a testament to the strength of the community. It's a testament to the high quality of the people who were adversely impacted by the race riot.
And the importance of learning about our history so the city can heal, ultimately making Tulsa a place everyone feels welcome, that everyone can be proud to call home.
It makes the society better. That's why we believe in public education, right? Because an educated public leaves us to all have a better quality of life.
And so I think it's more than just the history of violence and destruction. It's also this really story about courage and persistence and resilience.
Well, you get an opportunity now to see that people are pointing towards education as a vehicle to improve race relations. If people were to understand and to listen, at least know some of the history, they have a better understanding of how this has been going on. To have a riot that took place and burn down everything that Black people were doing at that particular time is very similar to the kinds of things that happened in the riots right now. We're going to go on, and the last person we're going to listen to is a description of a most intense, heartfelt form of racism ever experienced. Let's listen to this one.
Before we celebrate the freedom most Americans have, we must fight for the freedom all Americans deserve. Because all lives can't matter until Black lives matter.
I used to be a runner in high school and college, and in my late 30s, I began to jog. Early wave joggers, one of the most foolish things I ever did. And I was jogging near my house in Washington. I was an assistant attorney general of the United States, best friend of the attorney general of the United States. I was jogging near my house. And a police car came by. Fortunately, I had my Justice Department credentials in my hip pocket. Boy, I kept on jogging. My hair was beginning to gray, and I was jogging along. Boy, I keep on jogging. Hey, you boy! Spotlight on me. Boy, you better stop! I think I better stop. And so I stop, and two white cops get out, slam me up against a wall, spread my legs, and then spray my legs, hit me pretty hard between the legs, and it hurt very much. I kept saying, look in my back pocket, reach in my back pocket. Boy, you robbed the store. Boy, this, boy, that, boy. They pulled out this thing, and it was a nice leather thing that said I was a Justice Department official. Oh, they melted. Oh, you look just like we had a call. You just like it fits you too. Oh, sir, blah, 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 blah. Well, of course, I called the police chief the minute I got home, and those guys were suspended and disciplined. If I had no credentials in my pocket, I would have been in jail that night. Middle class, 37-year-old father of two children, doing nothing more than jogging. That's not the only time it happened to me. Well, if it would happen to me, imagine what would happen to a 17-year-old Black kid in the inner city. The man speaking is Roger Wilkins. I'm David Hoffman, and I filmed this interview with Roger back in 1989. And this 72-year-old man is telling me of his experiences growing up in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s. He had a really tough time. Although he came from a middle-class family, became a lawyer,
I truly won a Pulitzer Prize working for the Washington Post as a journalist with Bob Woodman and Carl Bernstein, the famous Watergate investigation. So I'm interviewing Roger in 1989, and we really hit it off. He was ready to talk, and I was ready to ask. And I said to him, be yourself. Just let me know what you felt, what you saw, and think about it in terms of future generations.
He had a daughter, Elizabeth, and he said, I'm going to talk like I'm talking to her grandchildren. So here we are in the present with all that's going on in the country right now, the racial animosity,
stuff in the streets, the government, the desire to make things better. And I'm thinking of Roger. He died at 74 of dementia, and he was speaking to me at that time for the future. Well, in the future, I hope you enjoy or find provocative what Roger had to say.
In the early 50s, America was a horribly segregated country. It was as if the whole South was a rotten fruit that everybody could smell. There were a couple of notorious lynchings in Mississippi. A black kid named Emmett Till was holding a white woman. They killed him. A black guy named Mac Charles Parker, who was accused of having raped a white woman, taken out of jail, killed, thrown in the river. I think both those guys were thrown in the river. Blacks were routinely pulled out of cars and beaten up by state troopers all throughout the South. Black poverty was just horrible. It was being shown in magazines. And then the Supreme Court decided that it was unconstitutional for states to run segregated school systems. And little cute, clean, starched black kids began to show up on people's television screens, being walked to school by their parents, and screamed at by white people. The contrast could not have been more stark. The white people who were screaming were, the caricature is the people, working class people, you know, not terribly clean. Some of them were obese, faces distorted with anger. Screaming obscenities at 6-7 year old children. Well, television was new, everybody was glued to it. That was one. Two, the country had fought this fight for democracy. Blacks felt it, whites felt it. And blacks were restless. They just sitting on the back of the bus, being relegated to the upper floor of a theater, sometimes to only one row of a theater, going to a gas station when your bladder was full and not knowing whether you'd be permitted to use the bathroom, having white people be just as rude to you as they chose to be, giving you absolutely no respect, not being able to try on clothes that you bought at stores, all of that stuff. And worse was going on. And the immigrants knew it, and they had tried to avoid it. But when blacks started taking their children to school, the North could no longer avoid the stinking, rotting fruit. And the South was represented by some of the most unattractive people in the Congress. Senator Theodore G. Bilbo of Mississippi was just an awful human being. And there were a lot of Southerners in the House who just spewed bile. And some of the North couldn't see it anymore. And blacks began to get hope from the fact that the Supreme Court had finally said, when blacks interpreted this 54 decision to mean the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution include us. Just as we've always said, all God's children are equal. And so we started to move. And white people thought, that's right. And a lot of white people joined in.
You sound like you're talking about sort of the continuation of the Civil War, the way you described it.
Segregation and the legalized oppression of black people was a continuation by the white South of the Civil War. That's exactly what it was.
it was taken out on black people. Their venom against the white northerners, and saying, you may think that you took our way of life away from us, but you're wrong, and your fully social theories are wrong, too. So what's the continuation of the Civil War? No question about it.
I want to ask you about some very basic concepts as we will perceive them. Integration. What did integration mean?
Well, integration had another connotation that was, I mean, it was squeezed the same way communism squeezed economics out of us. You couldn't say that you wanted integration to be all mixed up because the white senators kept on saying, well, all I want to do is sleep with white women. They say, no, well, we don't want to sleep with white women. Keep your darn women. They're not that cute anyway. We don't want them. What we want is good educations for our children. And I think that integration for us meant freedom from oppression. I don't think that black people really thought of joining the country covered as a fact. They thought, get rid of this humiliation. First of all, get some equal education for our children. That everybody knew. That was a goal. Get equal education because that's our future. But don't tell me I can't go to the bathroom anymore. Don't tell me I can't sit anywhere on the bus or in the theater. Don't tell me that. I don't. It's just too terrible. I don't think it was a positive thing. I just think it was getting rid of all of this oppression. Man, you cannot understand how horrible it was to have to contemplate a trip south. And the third thing was freedom from fear of being injured in the south. But a trip to the south for a northerner was fraught with peril because you were worried that you run a car out of gas and some person would be violent to you and you have no recourse to the law because the law was totally unfair. And that, and then once you got to the town, when you were being, if you had, usually if you're wise, you had made arrangements to stay with friends because you couldn't stay at the local hotel. And there was often no public place to eat. Well, I'm going to be rid of all of that stuff. I think if I thought about it, I would have thought that white people's bad views of black people are based on ignorance. And when we get together, they will cease to be ignorant about us, and they will, the scales will fall from their eyes, and they will begin to be decent. That's what I thought. I was pretty naive, but that's what I thought. I think that black people are always super Americans. We had to believe in America more than other people did in order to have any hope, in order to live, in order not to go crazy. We had to believe that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments meant something, and that the Declaration of Independence, though written by a slave owner, did mean the full scope of the words. So once we had the opportunity to make it work, we went full bore at it. It had this terrible itch of humiliation in our daily lives that we wanted to get rid of. But we also had something else, and that was a very powerful faith in the decency of white people. I no longer have that faith. But we had it then, and that was, if we can only demonstrate to white people how rotten this system is, most of them will change, and the country will change very rapidly. I think that gave us our discipline. That faith, both in the country and in the decency of white people. White people owned everything. They owned the means of, they owned all the payrolls, and they owned all the cops. They owned all the criminal courts. And the ownership of the country is a great enforcer. Black person get out of line, he's deemed crazy and he's dealt with. Sometimes he's killed, sometimes he's sued for, he's prosecuted for tax evasion. Sometimes he's fired. Black people knew. And earlier, of course, you got killed or whipped, slavery does. So black people knew that it was very dangerous to express anger to white people and tell white people how they felt, how stupid they thought white people were. And so the other black comedian said, "Boss asked me what the world like, I look in his face for I look outside." I mean, that kind of summed up the universe, the emotional universe within which black people had to operate. So it wasn't until the 50s and the 60s gave black people a little elbow room in the society that we could begin to express what was within us and express our true outrage at this horrendous wrong, continuing wrong that had been done to us over 360 years. Which makes Frederick Douglass all the more astonishing. He made a 4th of July oration in 1852 when there was still slavery. And he said, "What is your 4th of July? A hypocrisy and a mockery." Like I said, in 1852, unbelievable. If I said something in 67 when I was 35 years old, it had antecedents back in the segregated schoolhouse, you know. It had antecedents when people threw stones at me when I wrote to school. It had antecedents when people called me nigger. It had antecedents when people spit great gobs of gooey, nasty spit on my bicycle seat. So that he probably had also immediate stimuli, but the passion that went into what I might have said in 67 had a depth that was as deep as my entire being. Ralph Ellison wrote a great American novel called The Invisible Man. One of the great indignities that black people suffered was being invisible. White people were not seeing me, or as Ellison said, "What you see is something on the fringe of me, or what you see is a figment of your imagination, but you refuse to see me." What those people were saying, you're doing all this for the South. Now see me. Here I am, right in the middle of New York, right in the middle of Chicago. See me. Do something. I need a job. I need a better school. I need something. And this is awful. So what I saw, despite the destruction, I was pleased because the invisible ghetto dweller was becoming visible. America finally was being forced to confront the fact that the maimed and the wounded from oppression were in the inner cities, and something had to be done about their plight. People didn't talk about police-community relations, and they weren't not very many integrated police forces, and the ones that had them had blacks at the lower end of the totem pole. And blacks saw the police as occupying armies. Mm-hmm. And police were insensitive and thought that their job was to contain the niggers with heads. And many of the riots around the country were triggered by an incident. The one in Harlem was a guy, cop shot a kid. One in Detroit, cop shot a kid. One in Lutz, cop shot a kid. Black power means to me when I sit now in 1989 and have my 60-year-old black child on my lap and her little short afro, and I nuzzle my face in her hair and I say, "Oh, I love your hair. It is so wonderful. And your brown skin is so pretty." That's a lot of what black power left for me. It was a rejection. It was a fundamental rejection of all those rotten lies that white people have told us all this time about us. That my wild nose and my thick lips and my kinky hair made me inferior. That there is no way that my 30-year-old daughter can be as beautiful as Michelle Pfeiffer. Righteous. But we believed it. We believed it because they had the culture. They had the power. They made the movie shows. And they put Rita Hayworth on the cover of Life magazine instead of Lena Horner or some other black woman who had blacker features than that. They were the ones who made us the buffoons and the studs and the mammies, you know. They were the ones who told us we were slow and couldn't talk right and all the rest of it. And the worst thing you can do to a human being is to make her or him believe he doesn't count. Can't do anything. And of all the things that all the offenses that were done to me and other people about which I get angry, that's the one that just drives me crazy. It's not abstract to me. I mean, when I say these things, of course I understand what it means for millions of other black people, but it's also me personally. It's my children personally. It's my defense of my children. And I'm profoundly offended that the society still assaults all three of my children that way. Profoundly offended. It makes me so angry I don't know what to do. When you have something that is that explosive, of course it is not going to be contained so that
it doesn't hurt somebody. So it becomes
not just black and beautiful. Black and beautiful, you're haunting. It becomes a weapon. And it did. The country I live in now doesn't bear any resemblance to the country I was born into. And black people are so much freer. Now, there's still this horrid thing in the ghetto. It's 30%, 33% of black people are still impoverished. So I'm not saying that it is nearly over. But we are so much freer of the feeling that every white person might do us damage or hurt us, and that we can't be free and expansive, or that we have to be ashamed of our color. A lot of people were strong enough and clear enough all forever who said, look, the racial problem in America is not about defects in black people, it's about defects in white people. A lot of people really understood that in their gut. But not until the 60s did large masses of black people really begin to understand that and say, hey, I have a right to be a human being. I have a right to take a deep breath, you know. I do not have to be judged, and I don't have to care if I take a deep breath what this white man down here says about it. And, you know, I'll tell you something. In the years since then, I have had negative, stupid judgments made about me by white people. Some of them took bread out of my mouth, you know. Some of them made me less well-known. And it never really hurt because I really have a sense that most white people are not competent to judge me because they don't know where I've come from. They have no sense of it. They don't know what glories are in my achievements or in the achievements of most black people I know.
Well, we're going to stop right there. You had an opportunity to, on this particular last one, here is what's called the most intense, heartfelt description of racism I've ever filmed. But more importantly, as my subscriber know, I have done thousands of interviews in my life, as stated by the David Hoffman. This interview with journalist, civil rights advocate, lawyer Roger Wilkins was one that I never forgot. That's
gives you a complete picture over a period of time of different kinds of things that have been going on. And we will continue with this as we go on with our next show on Monday. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Have a good weekend.